This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Hikikomori, or extreme social isolation, was first identified in Japan in the 1990s. Dr. Alan Teo, a psychiatrist with the Veterans Administration Portland, said since then, hikikomori is being seen everywhere, from the hermits of the Middle Ages to young Americans who live with their parents and cut themselves off from society. So Dr. Teo thinks that the condition needs to be regarded as a behavioral problem in his own right, and that the first step towards this is to come up with a definition. So Dr. Teo, who is an associate professor of psychiatry at the Oregon Health and Science University and also a research and psychiatrist in the VA Portland healthcare system, joins me now on the line from the US to share more. Welcome, Dr. Teo. How are you today?
Wonderful. Yeah, thanks for reaching out.
Yeah. So, Dr. Teo, I mean, maybe to start off with, we can talk about, you know, what this whole Japanese term hikikomori means, you know, and how might we translate that word and its connotations into English?
Yeah. So you can usually translate hikikomori as social withdrawal. Or I talk about it, I'm a psychiatrist, meaning that I see patients in the hospital with mental health problems. And we think of hikikomori nowadays as a syndrome of social withdrawal. So usually we'll talk about it as social withdrawal, a social withdrawal syndrome, or a severe form of social withdrawal.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I know literally it means like pulling inward, you know, being confined. Am I correct?
Yeah. So hikikomori is a Japanese word, but the ironic thing is that the word originally came from English, meaning that the Japanese psychiatrist who invented the term, Dr. Saito, used the term social withdrawal, which is used in some of our diagnostic manuals in psychiatry. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is that at the time he was looking to take that and translate it into Japanese.
Right.
So the Japanese word actually originally was shakaiteki hikikomori. Shakaiteki means social. Mm-hmm. And then hikikomori is more that literal form of withdrawing or drawing inwards.
Okay. All right. And so you mentioned Tamaki Saito. So he was the Japanese psychologist. He specialized, I think, in puberty and adolescence. And he was the one who described young people who had withdrawn from society in the late 1990s. Am I correct? Can you describe some of the incidents that occurred soon after this definition was coined and how they actually shaped the public's perception of hikikomori?
Yeah. So the public perception really began with this set of observations that Dr. Saito wrote in a book. And this is essentially what happens in medicine frequently, is when we discover a new phenomenon, doctors, psychologists, others will describe the cases that they're seeing in their practice. Mm-hmm. And so what he was seeing at that time was adolescents, 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds, typically adolescent boys who were becoming essentially modern day hermits.
Right.
But that perception, that perception of the 90s has lingered in some ways that is now out of date, meaning that hikikomori is a much broader problem than simply boys holding up in their rooms.
That's right. And I mean, is there any sort of historical evidence to suggest that hikikomori existed earlier than the 1980s or the 1990s? Or would you say this is primarily a modern phenomenon?
I think it's probably been around a long time, but the 80s and 90s is when in Japan, doctors were starting to describe it. And they actually, in the research that I did looking at older publications, there were other terms that were used. There's other terms like tojikomori, which no one knows about because we don't use them anymore. So at some point, hikikomori, sort of people latched on to that. Mm-hmm. And it resonates, seems to have resonated with people, but it probably existed, well before those initial descriptions.
Okay. And I mean, what are the hikikomori like as people? I mean, first of all, to what extent can we generalize them as a group?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's the, I think that's where having a definition, a clear and consistent definition that we're trying to do in my work is helpful.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Because generalizations, you know, tend to get us into trouble.
Yeah, of course.
Well, so hikikomori, the defining feature of hikikomori is this physical isolation, being largely confined to one's home, mm-hmm. And in extreme cases, being more confined to a person's room. So that means that, you know, what that looks like is people sort of spending much of their time in solitary activities, maybe spending time online or reading books, mm-hmm. things that don't require any interaction with other people.
Right.
And age, things like age that's an example of where our traditional, the sort of older conception that this only affected young boys is an out of date perception. Mm-hmm. In Japan, for instance, they're now using a term, to 80-50 to describe the notion that many of the hikikomori are getting older, are 50, you know, 50 years older, old or above.
Wow.
And so there's been this concern about aging, the aging of hikikomori, and the fact that many of them are not adolescents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I was reading about this, you know, a cabinet office survey. This is in Japan. This was in 2015, and it said that the total number of social recluses in Japan is thought to be over about 1 million. And you know, so much of the Japanese government has begun to take an interest in the number of hikikomori. You know, because it's quite a problem. I suppose they perceive it as.
Exactly. Yeah. So it means that we really need all hands on deck in mm-hmm. terms of thinking about how to help people. It's obviously concerning if people have been withdrawn for years or even decades at a time. Mm-hmm. But it also means that it's not going to be as simple as one solution for one age group.
Yeah.
Let me give one brief example, which is listeners that, you know, listeners that are from other countries, such as the UK, and to some extent here in the US, there's more and more attention to loneliness and social isolation. Traditionally, we think of that as a problem of older adults, of elderly who may not be able to get out of the house. Mm-hmm. And again, each of these issues, they're interrelated, but they require different and creative solutions to help whether you're an isolated older person or whether you're a more socially withdrawn hikikomori.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've said before that the medical profession hasn't traditionally recognized social isolation as a health issue, or we don't pay attention to it. And why do you think that is?
Yeah, I mean, medicine, the culture of medicine changes slowly. I mean, I don't think it's limited to medicine, but getting people's attitudes and sort of traditions to change takes a lot of time. Mm. So a lot of that depends on our training. You know, if I think about my medical training, we did learn in medical school about what we call social determinants of health. Mm-hmm. And that's a fancy term, but the idea is that basically many things that are in our social environment, whether we're surrounded by pollution, whether we have access to healthy foods or sugary and fatty foods, mm-hmm. we recognize that those factors affect our health. The ironic thing is, again, social is in the term, but we often don't think of social relationships and social connections as a social determinant of health.
That's right.
So we need more. I think part of this is just getting our training of doctors and other medical professionals to really incorporate attention to social connections and relations.
I'm speaking today to Dr. Alan Teo. He's an associate professor of psychiatry at the Oregon Health and Science University. He's also a researcher and psychiatrist in the VA Portland healthcare system. And we're discussing hikikomori, something that, you know, Dr. Teo thinks we need to have a new definition for. And we're going to talk about that after this quick break. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs, and joining me on the line from the US today is Dr. Alan Teo. He is an associate professor of psychiatry at the Oregon Health and Science University. He's also a researcher and psychiatrist in the VA Portland healthcare system. And we're discussing hikikomori, you know, which is a social condition that was first identified in Japan, but, you know, something that Dr. Teo thinks needs a broader definition because it is quite a worldwide phenomenon. So, Dr. Teo, you know, you have proposed new universal diagnostic criteria for hikikomori and a framework for defining pathological social withdrawal in the digital age. So in particular, your recent article in the February issue of the journal World Psychiatry highlights four key aspects of a newly proposed definition of hikikomori. Could you elaborate on those for me?
Yeah, so the key to defining hikikomori first is that there is physical isolation and that isolation is in one's home, you know, however a person would define that. Mm-hmm. And then within that, we're trying to quantify so that doctors, whether you're a doctor here in the United States or a doctor in Uruguay, you can use the same criteria. We're trying to specify that isolation, that you can't go out of the house more than 3 days a week. Mm-hmm. So if you're spending time and rarely leaving the home, no more than 3 days a week, that would meet the first key criterion, first part of the definition. And then the second and important piece here is that you need to have this isolation and withdrawal be sustained. It has to be sustained for at least 6 months. There is some discussion about whether that's the right length of time, and really at some level it's arbitrary. But the point here is that 6 months tells you that this is not a blip in time. This mm-hmm. is something that is a persistent problem.
That's right.
And the third thing I'll just mention here in terms of thinking about a definition that can help doctors and patients hopefully is that really time alone, even long periods of time alone, there's nothing intrinsically bad about that. And so to define this as a problem or a clinical issue means that sustained social withdrawal, it has to be causing some problems in your life. It has to be preventing you from getting the things that you want to get done. It either is causing you mental distress or is preventing you. When I talk to hikikomori, they'll talk about having struggles with getting a job, holding a job, having to drop out of school because they're isolated. Mm-hmm. So those are the types of things. It is not sometimes I will have people contact me and say, this is a choice. You know, hikikomori is a lifestyle. If it is your lifestyle and if you're doing fine and you're happy and it's not messing up all of your relationships with your family members, mm-hmm. then that's mm-hmm. fine. I wouldn't call it hikikomori. But the people that I hear from are family members that are at their wit's end, and they have a relative, they have a child, someone who has been in this sustained state of withdrawal and really, really not getting along well in life.
So, you know, I guess, you know, for someone who doesn't quite understand, how unusual a manifestation is hikikomori to a more familiar condition like depression or schizophrenia? You know, hikikomori is obviously a distinct condition, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there's similarities and there's differences. So hikikomori, I think the simplest way that I like to think about it is hikikomori is sort of the severe form, specific form of social withdrawal. Mm-hmm. But there are elements of isolation and avoidance of social contact that mm-hmm. we see in many different psychiatric conditions, right. Like depression. I see veteran patients that have post-traumatic stress, and one of the signal features we see with that is people isolating. So there's some overlap there. I would say that, you know, it's important to notice that this is the case in many different areas in psychiatry. So anxiety, you know, we think of our thinking around anxiety, in particular panic, what we call panic attacks, has changed. And I think it's kind of similar here to hikikomori. Mm-hmm. You can have a unique and severe condition where you have panic attacks. We call that panic disorder.
Right.
At the same time, you can have an occasional panic attack, and that's part of something else. And so hikikomori is like that.
Okay. And, you know, what types of treatment or rehabilitation are available for people who are identified or who identify as hikikomori? Or, I mean, you know, if hikikomori are socially isolated from others, how are they identified and diagnosed in the first place?
Yeah, so two different pieces there. First, what's available right now? And, mm-hmm. and number two, what's the process?
That's right.
So first, for the available right now, The unfortunate news is there's not a go-to treatment. There's not something I would call a gold standard treatment. Mm-hmm. So we are doing, my colleagues, for instance, Dr. Takahiro Kato in Japan is leading some really important research where they're looking at some new interventions, things that involve training, providing training and education to family members, mm-hmm. for instance.
Right.
There's been a little bit of research, but we don't have anything definitive to recommend. However, I think there is a general process for evaluation that's helpful. And this is how the process goes. First is usually a family member reaches out to someone like me first. So providing support and resources to a family member, providing education as well as helping them in terms of their interactions, their conversations with their family member who has hikikomori, I think that's helpful as a first step. Mm-hmm. The second step would be working out an arrangement so that the affected person, the hikikomori, him or herself, can get in and get a psychological, psychiatric evaluation. And then the third step after that is to work on enhancing their ability to participate socially, to get practice as well as get sort of social rehabilitation.
Mm-hmm. And, what happens if someone who is socially isolated or, who is hikikomori, what happens if they refuse treatment?
Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, why the research is slow to progress in terms of treatments, because it's very common, Juliet, that there is a refusal to treat. So that's mm-hmm. why the first step is working together with the family members. I don't think you can drag someone out of the house. I do think that, one of the things that we think is contributing to hikikomori, particularly in Japan, is parenting practices, meaning that it's not a good idea to facilitate someone being able to stay holed up in their room. It's not a good idea to sort of create incentives for that to continue on. And so I think there's possibilities for, again, if it's a parent who has an affected child, if it's that sort of case, think about ways to sort of incentivize getting out of the room, getting out of the house, or at least not reward them mm-hmm. for staying indoors.
Okay. And, have you observed cases where hikikomori have successfully, reintegrated back into society and perhaps also flourished? And if so, what steps did they take and what help did they receive to achieve this?
Yeah. Well, it's one of the memorable cases that I dealt with when I was first getting interested in this area was an American that I treated when I was in residency. Residency is when you get your specialty training in medicine. And so I worked with an American hikikomori and provided what we call exposure therapy. What that is that I sort of worked with him, together with him, and created a plan so that he could gradually get experience going out of the house, interacting with people. He started by going to cafes and writing and journaling in a cafe, for instance.
Okay.
But it was very customized to his needs.
Okay. And so far we've been talking about hikikomori as a distinct phenomenon. However, to what extent could it be seen simply as the extreme end of a wide spectrum of behavior? Let's talk about Japan, for example. In Japan society, because they include individuals such as freeters, the people who lack full-time employment or unemployed. And then there's the NEETs, the not currently engaged in employment, education, or training. And then there's something called the parasite singles, a single person who lives with their parents beyond their late 20s. So, to what extent is this just the extreme end of all these different sort of spectrums of Japanese society?
Yeah, I think the key difference for hikikomori, the way that I think about it and work on it, is that we're dealing with this as a medical issue. Mm-hmm. And so again, medical issues can affect your ability to work. They can affect employment, but the employment is not the cause or the defining feature. Mm-hmm. So the two interrelate, but they're not exactly the same.
Okay. All right. And that is something else I wanted to talk about. What are the wider effects of hikikomori on society? Not just in Japan, but also across the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, huge impacts. If you think about family, I've already brought up family. I think of this as a ripple effect. So an affected person is surrounded by a family. The family is often struggling in terms of how to work together with their family member that has hikikomori. And then if you think about the broader social system, schools, how do schools handle individuals who won't go to school or who have dropped out of school? How does a society handle if there are large enough numbers of hikikomori? And we certainly see that in Japan at a minimum. Mm-hmm. How does a society sort of handle the loss of young people who aren't able to contribute to the workforce? Yeah. So I think there's lots of reasons that policymakers are interested. And we're starting to get some interest now that we have a definition of hikikomori. We have some measurement scales too. I think other countries can start to do the work here to figure out how extensive of a problem is this in not just Tokyo, but Turkey.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, broadly, how would you describe the current public perception of an attitude towards hikikomori? And do you believe that it can be changed?
Yeah. I think the challenge with the public perception is we think of these behaviors, behaviors related to our mental health. We think of them as somehow a failing of our willpower. Mm-hmm. We think of mental health problems as something that you're to blame for, and that's exactly the wrong way to think about it.
That's right.
We have more awareness, for instance, now that addiction is dysfunction in the brain that it needs to be treated. Mm. And so I think of hikikomori as something like that, where sometimes it looks like a choice to withdraw, but we really need to have more empathy and sympathy for these folks and work towards assisting them, providing them with care and assistance so that they can recover. And it's definitely doable. I was just contacted recently out of the blue by email by someone who he identified as a former hikikomori, someone who lives near me and heard me on our local radio station saying, wow, I've been through this and I'm doing better now. And if I can contribute to your research and help you figure out ways to help other hikikomori, I'd love to do it. So to me, that's really encouraging.
Well, that's wonderful for you and for the research that you've been doing. I mean, you've been doing this for a long time. And, you know, how are you going to continue in this research? And I mean, obviously, raising awareness is a very important thing. So how are you going to take this forward?
Yeah, so one, there's several pieces that we're trying to work on. Number one is we're trying to, my colleague, Dr. Kato in Japan and I, we're two countries, Japan and the U.S. We're trying to build an even larger international consortium of researchers so that we can bridge the gap across countries, not have to reinvent the wheel in every place. So we're trying to build this community of researchers interested in hikikomori connect up with each other. And then extending beyond that, it's not just a research issue. In other words, I feel very strongly that the best progress comes when we have researchers working hand in hand with community, for instance, community groups. Those are the groups, the community organizations that are dealing with hikikomori on the ground. And I think we can learn from each other, but we do need to work together to make the most progress. So building those networks of researchers, building networks internationally, building collaboration. Mm-hmm. The last thing that I'm trying to do locally here in the United States where I live, I'm trying to build a clinic, a sort of consultation clinic for hikikomori. Uh-huh. So I'm in the process of sort of getting the permissions and things like that set up.
Okay. All right. You know, hopefully this becomes a more widely recognized around the world. And I mean, I think the most important thing is, of course, to have that new definition. You know, it's so important. Once you give something a language and a definition, you know, it helps people to understand better, to reach out and to know that they're not alone, or it's something that can be fixed in that sense. It's something that they can seek help for.
Exactly. I think the many people think that they're alone because by definition, they're spending time alone. But there's one important message here is that I've heard from many people in many different parts of the globe. This is, you know, do not suffer in silence. There are many others out there. And then if we can share this definition, we can also allow people to, you know, researchers to collaborate. And that way our progress will move forward more quickly. We can study, we can come in some sense, we can combine and share our data. But you can only do that if you're using the same definitions and measuring hikikomori in the same way.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Teo, for joining me today. I've been speaking to Associate Professor of Psychiatry, Dr. Alan Teo from the Oregon Health and Science University. And he's also a researcher and psychiatrist in the VA Portland healthcare system. And we were discussing hikikomori. If you'd like to find out more about Dr. Alan Teo, Dr. Teo, you have a website, I believe?
Yeah. It's just my full name, Dr. Alan Teo. .com. Mm-hmm. I'm on Twitter too, with the same handle, @DRALANTEO.
Okay. All right. So, you know, if you'd like to find out more about Dr. Teo's research, you can follow him on Twitter or you can head to his website. If you've missed any part of this interview or any previous Live and Learn interviews, you can search for the podcast on our BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9. The Business Station.